Obama knows about this because he writes about it, and I know because my great-grandfather was one of those coolies. But only a tiny fraction of Africans under British rule were provided with decent jobs or a decent education. During this period of ruling Africa, the Western powers were hampered in their attention to the needs of the continent by two world wars and the Great Depression. On the whole, colonization in Africa was a tragedy. But it might not have been had colonization lasted longer, as it did in India. In any event, what is more important than colonialism is what route countries took after colonialism. For the most part, Africa rejected the route to free market capitalism and adopted a route of centralized planning and African socialism. Overall, Africa rejected Jomo Kenyatta's approach in favor of the approach of Barack Obama Sr. Over the past half century, Africa has witnessed a succession of dictators and strongmen such as Mobutu Sese Seko in Zaire, Idi Amin in Uganda, and Hastings Kamuzu Banda in Malawi. These thugs quickly learned the language of anti-colonialism and used it as a pretext to confiscate property and appropriate it for themselves and their cronies. Moreover, these men continued for decades to blame the failures of their societies on the legacy of colonialism, freeing them from the responsibility of raising the people's standard of living. Even today, Robert Mugabe of Zimbabwe, one of the last of the Big Daddy despots, has declared his mission as one of rooting out the last vestiges of colonial rule from his country. His strategy for doing that is to drive the European and Asian entrepreneurs out of the country and to seize the most productive lands of the white farmers. As a result, Mugabe's once productive country has been reduced to economic ruins, and most of the population is either starving or running away. Even as they contemplate their own miseries, however, the Africans can see the progress that is being made around the world. Younger Africans in particular are weary of the anti-colonial claptrap and socialist power grabbing. They want more Western investment in their countries, more free trade, and greater integration into the global economy. The wretched of the earth now realize that they don't have to remain wretched. They, too, can exploit the advantages of backwardness and become productive citizens who flourish in the world economy. Globalization has opened up new possibilities. How is Obama responding to those possibilities? We can see the answer by comparing Obama's attitude to the two countries that shaped his outlook when he was growing up, Indonesia and Kenya. Indonesia is a former colonial country that is moving quickly to become part of the global capitalist economy. Led by President Susilo Bambang Yudhoyono, Indonesia is following in the way of China and India. Currently, it is growing at 6%, one of the fastest growth rates in the world. So how has Obama treated Indonesia? With benign neglect, according to Bara Hasibuan, a leading Indonesian politician. More talk than substance, editorialized the Bangkok Post recently. When Obama was elected, the Indonesians erected a statue of him in a public park in Jakarta. Now, in response to more than 50,000 local signatures, the government has taken the statue down. As Protus Tanahandaru, who organized the signature campaign, told Time magazine, "I'm not against Obama, but it's wrong to have a statue in a public park of someone who has contributed nothing to Indonesia." Time's article was about how Obama is perceived not just in Indonesia, but throughout a continent. Why Obama is disappointing Asia. No one can deny, however, that Obama cares deeply about Kenya and, more generally, about Africa. So let us follow his sojourns there. In July 2009, President Obama traveled to Africa and spoke to the Parliament of Ghana. There was great anticipation, and of course, his message was transmitted across Africa. Obama was in a remarkable position. He was the first U.S. president of African descent whose very identity was shaped by his African father. Now he had the power to actually do something about the terrible problems plaguing the continent. What then did Obama have to offer today's Africa? Obama began his speech in a familiar manner. He blamed Africa's past problems on colonialism. I can give you chapter and verse on why the colonial maps that were drawn helped to spur on conflict, and the terms of trade that were uneven emerging out of colonialism. Then Obama moved to a detailed account of his family history, noting that in his grandfather's life, colonialism wasn't simply the creation of unnatural borders or unfair terms of trade. It was something he experienced personally, day after day, year after year. Obama recognized, however, that colonialism could not entirely account for Africa's current situation. Getting to the heart of the matter, he said, "Countries like Kenya had a per capita economy larger than South Korea's when I was born." One might expect Obama at this point to advocate that Africa learn from South Korea and liberalize its economy, open up its markets, exploit the advantages of backwardness, and integrate into the world economy. America could provide some of the technological and entrepreneurial know-how. But Obama said none of this. Instead, he offered some useless exhortation. "I have come here to Ghana for a simple reason. The 21st century will be shaped by what happens not just in Rome or Moscow or Washington, but what happens in Accra as well." And some more useless exhortation. "With strong institutions and a strong will, I know that Africans can live their dreams in Nairobi and Lagos, Kigali, Kinshasa, Harare, and right here in Accra." Earlier that day, Obama had taken his family to the Cape Coast Castle, which for centuries served as a Portuguese depot for slaves bound for America and the Caribbean. There, Obama had offered still more useless exhortation. "I think that this site helps to teach all of us that we have to do what we can to fight against the kinds of evils that sadly still exist in our world, not just on this continent, but in every corner of the globe." Speaking before Ghana's parliament, he finally did get down to practical issues. He called on Africa to set up public-private partnerships that invest in better roads and electricity. He called for a U.S.-Africa partnership to combat climate change, since Africa gives off less greenhouse gas than any other part of the world, but it is the most threatened by climate change. He did pledge substantial increases in our foreign assistance, including technical assistance for crop production. Obama expressed his hope that Ghana would not only feed its population, but one day become a food exporter. And that was it. Falling back into campaign mode, Obama concluded, "Yes, we can. Thank you very much." So this is what the Son of Africa came to offer Africa. Virtually nothing. He now has the power, but he doesn't know how to use it effectively. That's because Obama still cannot bring himself to abandon his father's anti-colonial ideology. That ideology calls for transfers of wealth from the colonizers to the colonized. If Obama can't convince Congress to approve more foreign aid for Africa, then he has no idea what else to do. The tragedy is that even if Congress were to approve the aid, it would not provide any lasting benefit. President Obama is still trying to apply his father's discredited formulas from the 1950s, even though they have no relevance to the world we live in today. The blunt truth is that anti-colonialism is dead. No one in today's world cares about it, except the man in the White House. He is the last anti-colonial. The rest of the world has no interest in how many schools the Belgians built or didn't build in the Congo, or how British officials in Kenya used to beat their house servants with canes. We are now living in a new world, and while most of the world is facing the challenges and seizing the opportunities of the 21st century, Obama refuses to embrace the promise of that growth for his African homeland or for the country he was elected to lead. Instead, President Obama is committed to bring down the neo-colonial forces in the economy and to lasso the rogue elephant that is America. Sometimes he wins, and sometimes he loses, but his intent is immutable. He is like the toy soldier. Even when he walks into the wall, he keeps going. Don't expect him to change direction or turn around. He cannot change. He is in too deep. Moreover, he doesn't want to change. He thinks of himself as on a righteous course, one that demands his own singular leadership at this crucial moment in history. While Obama regards himself as a model of confident cosmopolitanism, in fact, he has the narrow clarity of the one-eyed man. But what harm can one man do? Obama may have nothing to offer Africa, but are his policies harming people today? Even with the power of the presidency, Obama is not going to stop globalization or the information revolution. But there is another way that he could gravely damage the engine of global prosperity. That is by removing its cordon of protection, a cordon that is provided by the United States. Trade, after all, is vulnerable. It has always been vulnerable to thugs who want to disrupt trade routes and save themselves the trouble of buying and selling by taking and plundering. That's why, contrary to the views of some economists, global free trade cannot by itself solve the world's problems of scarcity and want. The world needs a policeman. And in case you haven't yet figured it out, the United States has that job. Call it empire, if you will, but America's role is very different from that of previous empires. Contrary to the charges of the anti-colonialists, the United States today has no intention of ruling or seeking tribute from other countries. America's foreign policy goals are basically to encourage people to trade with us and to make sure they don't bomb us. That's pretty much it. Of course, America could stop being the global policeman, but then there wouldn't be anyone to deter North Korea from nuking South Korea, or to prevent China from kicking around the small countries in its neighborhood, or to put a stop to genocidal wars in Bosnia or Rwanda or the Middle East. Someone has got to be the cop, and it's a role I wouldn't want to hand over to China, Russia, or the United Nations. There is currently no alternative to American leadership in the world, and deep down, even American liberals know this. So one great threat posed by Obama is that in weakening America, he will jeopardize the security and stability that America provides not only for its own citizens, but for the world. Then there is a second threat that Obama poses to his own country. America is currently the world leader, but it is faced with serious competitive challenges from leaner, hungrier nations like China and India. The economic balance has tipped in favor of those countries. They are growing 5 times faster than the United States. Chinese cities are bigger, newer, and glitzier than anything in America today. Also, China and India have larger populations, and this, too, has economic significance. Since China has more than 3 times the number of people that America has, even if the Chinese per capita income only rises to 1/3 that of the United States, China will have a bigger GNP than America. At current rates, the Chinese economy will overtake that of the United States in a few decades. The American era will be over, and if history is any guide, it will never return. What are we going to do about this? Here we are at a fork in the road. We can either draw from the wellsprings of American strength and get about the business of competing in the world, or we can give up on the American dream and lapse into a second-class position, as indeed Britain eventually did. If Obama has his way, America would look a lot like Obama's father wanted Kenya to look. Government-run peasant cooperatives, rationing land and natural resources in order to enjoy a modest self-sufficiency. Recall Obama's granny, outlining for him the simple life in the village before the white men came. Each family had its own hut. The men tilled the land and the women drew the water. The boys learned to throw their spears and the girls learned to grind millet. The elders watched over everything and made all the rules. I understand the appeal of growing up in a simple, settled society because I grew up in one. We didn't have all the problems of modern life. But then we also didn't have basic amenities that most people today take for granted. Equally important, there is very little mobility and opportunity in settled societies. That's why so many people from the old country would be thrilled to have a chance to move to the United States. Consequently, I understand Obama, but I don't sympathize with him. In fact, his warped ideology really scares me. His vision for America may be therapeutic for his psyche, but it is a ridiculous one for America in the 21st century. The dream of the two Obamas is not the dream that I want for America. Obama's dream is actually an American nightmare. It's time to act. Yes, we need change. And this time the change we need is to change the man in the White House. America isn't the rogue elephant. Obama is. It's not a matter of putting him out of his misery. It's a matter of putting him out of our misery. We also have to get rid of his team of sycophants and enablers. I am thinking of Harry Reid, Chris Dodd, Nancy Pelosi, Barney Frank, the entire liberal Democratic menagerie. Do all these enablers, or even his own private staff, know who Obama really is and what his goals really are? I suspect they do not, because Obama's philosophy derives from his own unique experience. So they are, in a way, dupes of Obama and of his translation strategy. This would make Obama a true loner. But it makes no difference. The sycophants and enablers are the ones who are clearing the path for this Pied Piper, and we had better get rid of the whole crew before they take us off the cliff. More than this, we need to ask ourselves how we got into this situation. We need to re-examine what it is to be an American. This means we must no longer respond so lethargically to the competitive challenges we face. Ronald Reagan once noted that the American national anthem is the only one in the world that ends with a question. Oh, say, does that star-spangled banner yet wave o'er the land of the free and the home of the brave? Only we, through our resolution and through our action, can answer that question. This concludes the reading of The Roots of Obama's Rage by Dinesh D'Souza. Copyright 2010 by Dinesh D'Souza. This book was read by Sean Renette. This unabridged recording was published by arrangement with Regnery Publishing Incorporated and was produced in 2010 by Blackstone Audio, Inc., which holds the copyright. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Audio, Inc. If you would like to obtain a complete catalog of our titles or our monthly update telling you about new releases, call 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-729-2665. Or visit our website at www.blackstoneaudio.com. Thank you.